everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And it's Wednesday. My co-host in the studio with me, Dr. Sherry Siegel. Hi, Sherry. Welcome back.
Hi, Armand. Thanks for having me.
This is a very interesting subject we're covering here from so many different angles. You and I have been involved in this. You and I have been involved in this subject matter for a long period of time. We're talking about caregiving today. We're talking about what it's like to be a caregiver and a caregiver recipient. Because, Sherry, as a neurologist, I am sure you have run into so many cases where people are just bound. You know, I mean, they're just too sick to move. And you deal with the mates a lot?
Absolutely. The family is such an important part of the of my relationship with the patient. Not only is my relationship with the patient helping them to heal, but also taking care of the caregiver. To me, they are an extension or another part of the patient, and they suffer right along with the person who is called the patient.
Well, we're going to address that because we have in the studio today somebody who wrote a very interesting book called The Tough.
The Tough and Tender Caregiver.
And this is Rhonda Travland and... David Travland and Rhonda Travland, right, both did this. And what we have is we have them on air, and they're going to talk about a very radical approach to dealing with this stuff. And we're going to talk to them about it as well. So, David, are you on the air with us?
I'm on the air.
Good. And is Rhonda here?
Rhonda's not available. She is. We've got patients coming in.
I so much want her on air. Is it possible she could spend some time with her?
It's possible. I can probably grab her for a little bit midway into this interview to just say a few words. But see, I've got her taking care of our professional responsibilities in the office.
Yeah, I understand. I thought a little earlier we said we'd have her on air because I have some very specific questions for her as a woman who's going through this as opposed to, who has lived through this as well.
Right.
So if she could put anything on...
She has a unique perspective on all this, that's for sure.
I know she does. So if she could put anything on pause and pick up with us a little bit, I would really appreciate it.
Okay. When you're ready to take a quick break, I'll ask her to pick up.
Okay, I'll take a quick break now, and you could ask her to pick up, and I'll go to... And Sherry and I will just address the issue. How about that?
Okay. Hold on 1 second.
Sure. See, Sherry? I know she's there, and I know she can pick up the phone upstairs. So this caregiving issue is a really big issue. And here's this amazing couple. Here's what happened to them. David's a psychologist, right? And he is working with... He himself is a caregiver. He has lived with somebody for a number...
I'm picking up the phone right now.
Good. Good, good. Okay, Rhonda.
Hold on.
Sure.
Out there.
Hi, Rhonda. We're almost...
Hello?
Hello, Rhonda. Thank you so much for being on the air with us.
Thank you.
No, it's very important because what we did was when Sherry Siegel and I were putting this together, we said, we are so lucky we have two opinions here. And we have a man's opinion and a woman's opinion. And I think it's very important. So if you could stick with us, it's very important to me.
Sure.
Let me just give a little of your background. Your background first is you were involved in caregiving as a profession, right?
That's correct.
Could you talk about that a little bit?
I was a licensed nursing home administrator, so I did that for about 15 years.
You were doing that for 15 years?
Yes, as well as my personal caregiving.
And what was happening in your personal caregiving? What was the situation?
My husband's behavior started to change, and I didn't quite have a handle on it, but I knew enough to know that there was something wrong, and so I spent over a decade looking for an answer.
And so you went through the whole medical thing. Did you ever find a determined diagnosis that kind of told you what was happening?
Well, for about 5 years, we kept getting strange psychiatric disorders. And nothing seemed right, and I did work with dementia patients. So I kind of thought that that might be the problem, but it took several neurologists, at least five, to come up with a possibility that it was premature Alzheimer's.
And was this before there was something like neuroimaging where they could kind of check? I mean, I'm sure even though it's right down there in North Carolina where you guys are, did anybody run neuroimaging scans?
Only towards the end of getting a formal diagnosis did that happen, and even then there were misdiagnoses. Because at the time that we finally got a firm commitment that it was dementia, he was 38, so all of his 30s had been spent getting the wrong diagnosis.
Oh, my gosh, almighty.
And I kept thinking, if it's not going to be a physical problem, that's fine if it's a mental health problem, but we need to find out what it is so we can fix it and move on in some kind of normal. But a final outcome of Alzheimer's-type dementia was not really what I had been hoping for or expecting.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing, and I'm so glad you're on the air with us, because many of our audience are people who are with people who have mood changes. And then they have these mood changes, and you as a dedicated spouse, committed partner, you say, look, I'm in here, and we said in our contract, you know, for better or for worse, for richer or poorer, sickness and health, and I'm trying my best. So I'm sure you tried your best to stick in there until you got this diagnosis of Alzheimer's, and then it started. You could see how an early Alzheimer's could develop. Sherry, have you heard of, I'm going to ask my neurologist here, Sherry, have you heard of early Alzheimer's being like age 30?
Well, when younger people get dementing illness, sometimes there's a disorder called Pick's disease, and it affects the frontal lobe, which is responsible for personality, as Rhonda was describing.
Outbursts of anger and things like that.
Sometimes violence, and certainly changes to their ability to take care of themselves, take care of their families, work as they normally would.
Brutal. Brutal relationship. I mean, I know of people who have that with children. And that's one thing when it's your child, but when it's your spouse. Rhonda, what turned you around? What made you finally say, you know, okay, I've got to deal with this differently?
Well, exactly as what the other guest said, was that in the end, when we got a neurologist that was willing to treat us as a whole family, because it was a whole family disability at that point, he actually told us that it was, in all likelihood, Pick's disease, which nobody else had ever told us before, but he gave us a lot of advice in that it was going to be very difficult trying to be the spouse and raise minor children, and that the two, Pick's disease and minor children, don't work well under the same roof. So I knew I had to prioritize and make sure that my ex-husband was going to have the proper care while I also tended to my children. And that's about the time that I met David. And his philosophies on how to take care of myself first were the things that started making me make changes that were for the benefit of myself first and then the children and then my sick spouse, because our whole life was in disarray.
Wow. You know, we're talking to the authors, Rhonda Travland and David Travland, The Tough and Tender Caregiver is the name of the book. And this is quite a remarkable, well, kind of a departing from most of our philosophies. But I do want to learn about what your opinion is. So, David, thank you so much. And, Rhonda, please stay with us if you can.
I will. Thank you.
You know, send the kids down to take care of the patients. They all eventually wind up doing it. But David, if you can, you meet Rhonda and you have already been working on this. Now, you have quite a history with caretaking yourself, don't you?
Yes, I was married to a woman who had multiple physical problems and emotional problems. And
what kind of physical problems did she have?
She had two artificial hips. She was morbidly obese. She lost the ability to transfer out of her bed, so I had to buy an electronic hoist. She weighed 400 pounds, and I was unable to care for her other than to just treat her like a baby. She couldn't care for her own sanitary needs or anything like that. So I provided total
care. Oh, my God, David,
care.
That's brutal. David, that is more than, of course, a physical problem. There's something gone on there. What do you think triggered all of this change in her body? I mean, okay, the hip replacements I could understand, but she couldn't get out of bed and she weighed 400 pounds. What was leading her in that direction?
Well, of course, it was the weight gain that did most of it. That was the etiology of most influential. But, of course, as you know, all of this, as a psychologist, you know that all of this behavior is overdetermined. There were so many different causes going on.
But there was no physical condition that you could find that would lead to, like, a hormonal imbalance or something that you could say, look, this is what it's about. We're researching this. We're trying to find out what's going on. There was nothing you could find.
She had the best medical care we could find, and nobody could give us a definitive answer. It was just there, and it kept getting worse. It was a progressive thing. And they diagnosed it initially as fibromyalgia, but, you know, that's such an amorphous disease.
Sure.
But then she was diabetic, and, of course, that was weight-related. And then the diabetes kept creating all kinds of problems with additional discomfort and pain. So then she was on something like 200 milligrams of morphine sulfate.
Oh, my gosh. Well, that tells me where the picture really starts to go down.
It went downhill from there. So
of course,
we had
200 milligrams.
Drug addiction on top of everything else.
We were talking about this on our last program with the treatment of migraines, and we were talking about what happens when you introduce these drugs. And a certain drug like morphine sulfate, I believe, sends a signal to the body that it's time to die. You don't have to produce any more emotion. You don't have to produce any more of your own painkillers. It's just, we'll do it for you. And the drug is, I believe, a killer. You know, I think it's a killer. Just not that it is a killer, but once it happens, then you get the addiction reactions, the addiction problems, the short-temperedness. Now, you as a psychologist, when you saw the morphine sulfate coming, wouldn't you have done something to step in there and say, no, not this direction, we can't do it?
I tried to do that, but her physicians pretty much were... They believed her story about the chronic pain and so forth, and it was a little bit like the boiled frog syndrome. You know about that?
Sure. But go ahead. Let's talk about it on air. Go ahead.
You put a frog, which is a cold-blooded creature, in a cold tub of water, and you stick the tub of water on the stove, and you turn up the temperature. And then water gets hotter and hotter and hotter, and the frog doesn't know any difference until finally the frog just dies and didn't know why. Well, that's what happens with this insidious escalation of disease processes. It just gets worse and worse. It starts off with what seems like a reasonable dose for pain management, and then the pain didn't go away, so we need, of course, more, and then we try different pain management techniques. They don't work, so now we've got more pain management medication, and it just escalates.
So it's
You brought up the essence of what's wrong, what happens to caregivers, and that is, especially in a spousal relationship, it starts off as an acute problem, something that was a sudden illness, something that was an emergency, and we leap into action to take care of that person that we love and that we're committed to, and over time, we don't stop behaving in that acute fashion when it became chronic. And that's the same thing. You know, as a professional, he may have seen that these were issues, but as a devoted husband, you put blinders on to that because you're trying to save the person that you married.
You know,
that's right. When you look at it differently as a husband than you do as a professional.
Absolutely.
And this is like a physician, don't try to heal yourself because you get too close to the problem, you know?
And the physician does need help. You talked about trying to find groups for yourself, for caregiving groups, you know, because you knew you needed some kind of help with that. Let me ask you, so eventually you and your wife had to have some kind of a decision, and you're going to talk about some of the things you did, about some of the ways that you guide people to grab hold of their lives when they're in this situation, and this is what you call the tough and tender caregiver. Could you tell me, what do you think? What's the step?
Well, the first thing I should say is that it got so bad that I called a well-spouse organization and asked them if they would put me in a support group, and they said, we don't have any in Florida where you live. Would you be willing to start one? I said, yeah, well, I've been trained as a group therapist. Certainly I can run a support group, but I didn't know if I could profit from one. So that's what happened first, was I created this support group, and my current wife attended the first meeting of the support group. So that's how we met. But I'll give you some examples. Everybody says...
So when you say you didn't profit from it, you meaning if you ran a group, could you make enough money to keep the group going? Is that what you meant?
No, what I meant was, will I get enough emotional support out of the group if I'm running it?
Wasn't that beautiful? You run the group and the first person you meet gives you just what you need.
That was an unintended an unintended benefit.
I'm not so sure. I've got to tell you the story. I know a man whose wife died, and he went to a grieving group where the woman who was running the grieving group found him very attractive, and the two of them got married. So this, it does somehow, somebody brings it around.
Especially when the problems resonate.
It does. That's exactly how I say it. We didn't intend to end up married, but there's a communion of heartache. That's a lot of the reason support groups work, is you find somebody finally in the world that understands what you've been through and what you're going through.
So the two of you had the good fortune of saying, we have to do something about the situation we are in. And the two of you had at least each other to hold hands to and say, okay, you're going to do this. You're going to do this with your husband. I'm going to do this with my wife. And you took tougher stands.
We did. And in fact, interestingly enough, what you don't know about my ex-wife is that she had an abdominal hernia that kept exploding, basically. And so she developed bed sores and so forth. And we had home health agencies constantly in and out attending to her infections. So we had infection control problems. And ultimately, I was able to convince a physician that the infection control problems were beyond my capacity. I ended up putting her in the hospital for wound management, and then I refused to take her back because I couldn't handle it. They didn't heal the wounds, so I wasn't going to take her back. So I said, you've got to find a nursing home to put her in because I can't do it anymore.
So
and
you
they put her in a nursing home, and then she promptly filed for divorce because I think what happens is that when we do this intense care, we develop a certain dependency in the patient, and they come to expect us to devote our lives and to become martyrs. And as we point out in our public speeches, martyrdom only seems to work after you're dead.
So did your wife even have a chance at it, David? I mean, she went into a hospital, and then you said, I don't want you back, and I don't want to divorce you. Did she know how you felt?
Well, hey, let me jump in here. He makes it sound a lot like this bravado that may sound good as an emotional issue for his self-esteem afterwards, but the truth is he set goals. He set goals for her. You're welcome to come home. I want you to come home, but you have to be able to do more for yourself and not depend on me. And that's when the anger started on her part. You know, he's been doing it all these years. Why now is he going to set standards for me to meet?
And so now you have this person who's over there who looks at you and depends her whole life on you, and you say to her, I am not going to suffer this way anymore. Here's my rules. Here's what I want. Now, you have a belief about this, David. I could certainly hear the wrath that grew inside you during all these years. You know, you were angry. That's clear. But you were also taking care of her. And then at one point, you just said, I've had enough. And at the point that probably which you said you had enough, you had met Rhonda and you said, okay, Rhonda, you know, I can't take this anymore. And so now you go over to your wife and you say to your wife, I can't take this anymore. I don't want you coming back. I need you to do certain things, which she probably couldn't do. And she divorces you. Now, why the divorce? I can't understand why she would divorce you. Why would she even want to divorce you? Because she would keep some kind of attachment. Why would she initiate a divorce?
Well, again, the behavior is overdetermined, but the short answer is that she was outraged that I refused to sacrifice my entire life for her anymore.
Sure.
And I had been doing it for such a long time that it apparently was a shock to her that I said, no, until you can stand up and until you get rehabilitated to the point where I have this hydraulic lift that I had to buy to get her in and out of her bed and in and out of her electric wheelchair. I said, until you get rehabilitated to the point where I don't have to do that anymore, then I will be delighted to have you back home again. But she really thought that that wasn't what I wanted. I even attended patient care conferences at the nursing home and said, this is the kind of rehabilitation that we require in order for me to take her home again. But she was unable or unwilling or some combination thereof to participate in that. We do not in the book, by the way, we in the book do not advocate leaving people who you've made a commitment to. We in the book, we give lots of practical advice, hard-hitting practical advice that will allow couples to stay together, but allow the caregiver to meet their own needs so they don't have the panic reaction of having to just get away in order to meet their own needs. We look
okay,
for
so
a
let's
balance.
Talk about let's talk about the beginning of it. The beginning of it becomes a conversation where
right.
you say, who is the highest priority here? And let's talk about how the two of you see that conversation with your mate.
Okay, you want to take this, Rhonda?
Go ahead,
well,
Rhonda.
For me, it was an issue of he was still in mild stages or mild to moderate behavior issues, and he had memory gaps. And he was very aware that the children would respond to him differently when he became oriented again. But that memory gap that he didn't own was filled with violence and filled with terror in our household. And he understood that it was changing the relationship with the children. So I sat down and explained to him that we couldn't live like this anymore. I was beginning to characterize it as domestic violence. And as much as I loved him and cared about keeping my family together, those issues became a priority. So I just kept talking about those until he also agreed that separation at first was the only answer to try to preserve the family. And I really worked within those confines of just taking it as we had to live separately.
When you deal with it, when you talk to him about that, you must have figured you had to find a calm time. There had to be a time. This is not a thing to kind of conversation to have in the middle of an agitation.
Right.
This is not one of those where you're fighting with each other and you say, that's it, now I'm going to tell you. You had to find the strand of love that existed between the two of you, and you had to ride that strand of love to something more logical, something not even more logical, more loving. Now, David, how did you do it? What happened with you? How did you finally say, how did you get your wife to understand that you were taking a new stance? Because it sounds like yours was much more aggressive. Yours was like, you know, this is it. I've had enough. I'm doing it my way.
Well, what I was reminded, I talked with a medical person who said that I had been developing, unbeknownst to me, a legal liability because the home health care people were basically, instead of taking care of her wounds, they were instructing me on how to take care of the wounds, and then they'd drop back out. And naively, I agreed to do some of that wound care. But I was reminded forcefully by a nursing home administrator who said, you know, you have a legal liability. Somebody can come in here from the state and know that her bed sores are not getting any better, and they can take you to court and charge you with criminal neglect. And I said, oh, my God. So I went to Judy's personal physician, and I said, these wounds, and then he examined her, these wounds I can't do anything with. They've been getting worse and worse, and I've got home health care coming in, and they're not helping. I've got to have some intensive treatment for these wounds. And so he put her in the hospital. She didn't want to be put in the hospital, but I didn't really feel like I had a choice but to do for her what she needed to have done in order to keep her wounds from becoming life-threatening.
Okay, but David, let me ask you a question. When do you think you lost the original love for your wife, the original one? When did it happen? Because, you know, I hear you talk. You're talking as a caregiver who's an angry caregiver. You know, you're saying to her, look, you're sick and you make yourself sick and this is the way it is and I can't take it anymore. But somewhere earlier on in this relationship that you had with Judy, you had a tenderness and a love. When did it go? Because it had to leave. The way you're talking, I could see it had to exit. It must have exited when you felt really trapped, when you felt like you just couldn't live anymore, you know? When did it leave? Do you remember?
No,
What's the crossover point?
Well, I ended up being married to her for 40 years. So somewhere after the first 20 years, things started to go downhill. And I would say during the last 10 years of intensive caregiving to her, where her attitude changed and her drug-seeking behavior escalated and all that, I think it probably at around 10 years before the end, the I don't know what you would call love, but the respect that I had for her earlier certainly began to diminish.
And it sounds, you know, in the book you talk about the marriage contract, and it sounds like the marriage contract wasn't being held up.
No, it wasn't. One of the things I'm fond of talking about here when we talk to caregivers, especially when they're caring for a spouse, is that when we get married in our society, we each acquire 50% of the voting stock in the marital corporation. The question is never whether we own the stock. We do. The question is whether we vote the stock or give our partner the proxy. But during that contracting process, the wife agrees to do certain things and the husband agrees to do certain things. And once illness becomes chronic, then all of a sudden one person is unable to hold up their end of the deal. And as we say, at that point, the contract isn't worth much. And it really needs to be renegotiated.
Well, I understand your position, David. I understand your position of saying that and seeing it kind of from the business end. You've mentioned the financial end of this many times. But if you had a child who got sick, your responsibility doesn't end.
Oh, that's right. It's a very different situation with a child.
Very different. You're saying if you're in a marriage or you're in a relationship, and there's only one or two reasons to be caretaking to the point where you sacrifice your life. One is that you have this kind of dedication, and you really feel this dedication, but you're taking care of yourself. And the other is this pathological kind of caretaking, which we're going to get into and talk about. Because there are some people who just love and live on other people's weaknesses. It makes them feel strong. It makes them feel powerful. And the more they could take care of the other person, the more the other person gets sick. And it's almost like a contract. I'll get sick for you to take care of me. So I'm feeding your needs and you're feeding mine. And sometimes you begin to wonder, who is really the one who's creating the illness? Sometimes it's the caretaker who's making the other person sick, by caretaking them the way they do, by infantilizing them, by making them little, by saying, I'll do everything for you. When we get back from our break, David is going to tell us about some of the direct confrontations that he believes a person should have with their spouse about how to kind of deal with this. And Rhonda's going to share more with us about her experience. This is Armand DeMille with Sherry Siegel. Sherry, this is really a hot subject. I'm really glad you brought this in. We're going to take a very short break of some music. And when we come back, we're going to, let me see if I can soften this up a little bit. How about a little soft music?
How about a little Brahms?
No, I got even softer than that. So remember, your phone will be open. We will be back with you in just a couple of minutes, my friends. This is Armand DeMille, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. WBAI.org on your computers. We're going to be back with you in just a couple of minutes. In the meantime, let's break your heart with something. And here we go. Where we go. Well, hold on with me, friends. Here we go. Justice is toughing us up.
I shouldn't care. I should go without sleeping. Strangely enough, I sleep well. But for a dream or two, but then I count my sheep well. Funny how sheep can lull you to sleep. Oh, I should care. I should let it upset me. But it just doesn't get me. Maybe I won't find someone as lovely as you. But I should care.
Another version of Brahms. And that was Mel Torme, my friends. I should care. You know, the tenderness that you don't understand between couples. Part of what relationships are is this caretaking thing, but he's absolutely right. What do you suggest, the two of you, what do you suggest for people to do to take care of themselves if they are being caregivers? What must you do for yourself? Because so many caregivers are caregivers for so long, and then something happens. Their mate dies or their mate leaves, and then they get so sick it's unbelievable. It's like everything that they've hidden kind of comes up. Have you seen that happen, David?
Yes, we believe that, for example, the quality of the relationship before the caregiving begins has a great deal of bearing on exactly how the course of caregiving will go. But yes, we see that caregiving for many caregivers is not a healthy thing. And in what I think is 40% of the time, caregivers precede the patient in death.
David, and Rhonda, may I ask you, if you were to make a list or categorize...
Wait, just a second. I wanted to just make sure we heard what David just said. 40% of the time that... the caretakers precede the recipient in dying?
Yes.
Wow. Meaning that somehow the caretakers wear themselves out.
That's right.
Wow, that's kind of really potent stuff. Because Sherry, you were saying.
Well, I was wondering how you could help caregivers understand the difference between a healthy caregiving relationship so that they don't, you know, kind of caregive into the ground, and one that might be pathological.
Well, yes. And would you like me to answer that, or Rhonda?
You do. Either one of you. Go ahead.
Rhonda, you there?
Yeah, go ahead, David.
Go ahead, Rhonda. It's time for us to hear your voice. You go.
Well, I'm like David's walking testimonial, and it's not because we got married. He helped me unwind the pathological part of my caregiving duties, and the issue... is that I let all boundaries go, and David has a very finely tuned banter about or patter about the way to keep the boundaries up, because caregivers that give and give and give and give get rid of all boundaries, and then it's a free-for-all and whatever else we have to offer.
What happens is that the caregivers let the person receiving the care intrude at all hours and in all ways, and it's almost like the caregivers give them carte blanche. So what we do is we say, draw a boundary around yourself as a caregiver, and this is what you will give and this is what you will not give. And it really helps, for example, and I'll just give you some ideas. You have to distinguish between what the care recipient needs and what the caregiver recipient merely wants. And if what they want interferes with what the caregiver needs, then the triage system isn't working properly. So one of the things we say to caregivers is create a rigid schedule. I will work on your breakfast needs between 7 and 9 o'clock in the morning, and from 9 o'clock until noon, you are on your own, and I'm leaving the house.
Okay, now David, hold on a second. Dear, how about this way? Dearest darling, I love you very much. I am going to set a rigid schedule, so I'm going to be doing a breakfast schedule between 7 and 9 in the morning. And then, my darling, I'm going to go off on my own, and you will take care of yourself for the rest of the period. That's the
same thing.
You said
that so sweetly, yes.
Yeah, it's the same thing. We're not saying any different. I'm just trying to say...
No. I'm talking to you, not to the caregiver. If I'm talking to the caregiver, I'm telling them how to say it the way you just said it.
Yeah, bring them some love there.
That is the way you have to do it. You do it with diplomacy.
When you get angry and you have somebody like a prisoner, you know, that you don't like, it's like, you know, a lot of the nursing homes, they treat their patients like that. You get this and you get that, and that's all you get. And then, of course, when the visitors come, they're very sweet. But they are nasty to the people who are in the nursing homes because they figure they're just going to set limits and set limits. Now,
I'm sorry, but as a former nursing home administrator, I take exception to that because some of the people that work in nursing homes, truly, after 15 years of doing this, are some of the most dedicated, wonderful people that I have ever had the privilege to work with, and they are not gruff and grumpy behind the scenes. Are there some bad apples? Absolutely.
Well, I guess I only hear about the bad apples because of my profession.
That's true about any industry.
Uh-huh. Okay, Rhonda, exception well taken.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
I want to say one more thing, though. That issue of talking sweetly, after years and years and years of caregiving, when you say as the caregiver, honey, darling, sweetheart, I'm going to be leaving for 2 hours, they're going to say, oh, no, you're not. I need this and I need that, and you're not leaving until I get it. So even the best pre-illness marriages have problems when caregiving erodes the respect you had for each other.
That's
you
true.
You have to talk assertively.
Well, you know, but here's another part of it as well. Let's think about the care recipient. The care recipient, let's say they've got some really horrible, horrible disorder, and they got something, and they're in bed, and they can't move, and they got some neurological disease, they got brain cancer, and they can't do things, and they just can't. There is something about being somebody who's sick, and when you're sick, you turn around to your partner and you say to your partner, look, I wish I weren't sick, but I am sick and I need your help. And it feels like you're justified in getting it because you're the sick one, you know what I mean? You don't want to be sick, but you're the sick one. And in a way, you feel like, well, if somebody's got to be sick and somebody's going to be crippled, sharing this with me. Get a little crippled with me.
Well, that's absolutely correct, and that's where David needs to talk about the feeling owed syndrome, because if you don't recognize that you feel owed as a caregiver and as the care recipient, the person with the illness, then both of you are feeling owed and taking it out on each other. And David, that's one of the big things that helped me, was understanding that I did feel owed, and until I got that fixed, I wasn't any good to anybody.
Wow, that's important. Okay, so let's talk about it. What is that, David?
Can we talk about the feeling owed syndrome?
Yes, please.
We are taught, brainwashed by our society, that it's wrong to be selfish. In fact, we hear things like, it is more blessed to give than receive. And what happens then is that caregivers are afflicted with this horrible sense of feeling guilty if they want to have some of their needs met, too. In fact, I'll give you a prime example, and that is one of the things that nobody apparently in caregiver books talks about is sex. It is assumed that as caregivers you're supposed to be celibate. So we have a whole chapter in our book on sex. But anyway, besides that, the idea here is that we have needs, as caregivers, and they have to be met. And it's all right to pretend that they don't have to be met, but as we say, the brain has a mind of its own. The brain keeps track of what we are putting into relationships and what we are getting back out of relationships using an internal ledger. And the ledger gets terribly out of balance, and it stays out of balance in a caregiving situation because the caregiver gives and gives and gives, and the recipient can give very, very little back. So it gets so out of balance at times that people become desperate. And one of the reasons that we wrote the book was in response to this statistic, which you may never have heard, and that is that 500 times a year, more or less, a caregiver commits murder-suicide, killing the person they're caring for and then taking their own life. And that is the feeling owed syndrome carried to an extreme. And so one of the things that we try to do is to help caregivers understand that they indeed have a ledger, that they indeed must pay attention to it, and that they must figure out a way to get as much of that imbalance taken care of as possible. And one of the ways they do that is that they put conditions on their caregiving that the person receiving the care has got to do absolutely everything they can possibly do for themselves instead of having all of their needs cared for, whether or not they are capable of caring for themselves or not. But the feeling owed syndrome is a deadly thing even in our society. How could a man take a gun into a crowded store and start shooting people? How could a mother drown her two children in a car? This is the feeling owed syndrome run amok, is what it is. And it's deadly for caregivers.
And David, what would you say is, I imagine that there are quite a number of caregivers who could be cared for by the ill person as well. What can you offer to them, and what would you ask them to ask of their spouses, the ones who might have the illness? How could the people with the illness take care of the caregiver?
Okay, now let me give you an interesting example of this. We just spoke a month ago to a group of spinal cord injury patients in wheelchairs and their caregivers. There were about 20 of each. There were 40 people in the group. And we were saying, you know, standing in front of the group, saying that everybody tells you to take care of yourself as a caregiver, but, of course, nobody tells you how. And we're going to sit here and we're going to tell you some of the things that you actually can do. You know, see, the book we wrote is not a memoir. It is a prescriptive book. Step one, step two, step three, how to take care of yourself. So we started going through these steps for these caregivers to be able to take better care of themselves so that they could remain a caregiver. And as we're doing this, the people in the wheelchairs are nodding affirmatively every step of the way, like they were acknowledging that if this caregiver doesn't do a better job of caring for themselves, they can't care for me.
Well, one of the things specifically would be if the healthy caregiving spouse is saying, I need some time off, the one that is dependent on the care needs to understand that together they can create a way for them to get the time off. And some things that we come up with doesn't involve having to spend money to bring somebody in, because that's one thing that is inherent to caregiving, is that it's extremely, there's financial issues that are involved. So we look for creative ways. It may be that they rotate homes with a family member so that they can get free respite, but they get out of the house.
Well, how about, Rhonda, while I've got you, how about sexual needs? How about if you're a caretaker and the person is so sick that sex dies between the two of you? How about the sexual needs of the caregiver? What do you guys believe? Do you believe you go get your needs met elsewhere? What do you think? It is an issue.
It is a huge issue, and there's a variety of things that we talk about. And in our culture, it is so taboo to talk to anybody about this subject that a lot of people bristle at first when we talk about it. And we advocate having an agreement between the two people. If your partner is able to discuss the issue comfortably, which a lot of couples are not, coming up with agreements, because sometimes the sick spouse is so sick they get to a point where they don't care where the caregiver gets their needs met. they just want to know that their caregiver's not going to ultimately leave them.
Well, that's the whole fear. I mean, that's
right.
the whole fear of it. It's like, it's so primitive, you know, in the, among the lionesses, when the female gorilla, when the female lion sees other lionesses coming around, she's not worried about the fact that the lion's going to have sex. She's worried that the lion's going to go off with the other brood.
That's
right.
Do
you know what I mean?
Exactly. So, and that's how we advocate really being able to try to talk about it.
But it's so hard because, you know, on the other hand, the care recipient is not getting their sexual needs met. So should we address the issue of how the caregiver should help the care recipient receive their sexual needs so as they could say, and also I have to go out and meet mine? I mean, you know, just because a person is sick doesn't mean they can't have sex. But what happens with almost invariably with caregivers is they turn off to their care, to their recipients.
That's true. And that's, we talk a lot about this, too, in our support groups, is that a lot of people are not told by their healthcare professionals what their limitations are. They're not told that there are sexual health devices in all medical equipment supply catalogs. There's positioning devices. There's things that can be obtained to help.
Is David barking? Because we're talking about sex.
Oh,
David started barking.
Oh gosh. But they're not given a lot of options through their healthcare practitioners, and so we help people start talking about it and looking for mainstream resources and start talking about things that they may not have entertained in their relationship prior to the illness.
It's kind of an important issue.
They're willing to entertain now.
You're right, because the public doesn't like to talk about this issue because, you know, so many people go off and they have affairs or they have other relationships and they go to massage parlors and they tell their mates, you know, you try to tell your mate about it, but your mate is laying there and they, you know, they don't have the option. So it's a question, you know. Now, the other part of it is when a caregiver gives their mate the contingency, I am going to go out now and take care of myself, I think it's very important to say, I'm going to go out and take some time for myself, but I'm not going out to be with somebody else. I'm going to go out to go to a movie. I'm going to go out to go row my boat. Because sometimes the big fear is always, if I let you leave the house, you're never going to come back. And so I think it's important for the caregiver to give consideration to the fears of the care recipient, not kowtow to them, not give in to them, but just say, I'm going out, but I want you to know I will be back, and I want you to know I'm going out to do so-and-so. And if it's different than that, have the fairness to say to your mate, I'm going out to be with somebody else, because that's what I'm going to be doing. And I think that's ideally the way it could work, even though I think practically it would be impossible. Just one last question. We're coming up to our last 6 minutes. Let me ask you this. We've seen such a heavy correlation. David, are you still with us?
Yes, I'm with you.
David, when you were young, was there any caretaking? Of course, we found that most caretakers were caretakers when they were children. Were you a caretaker as a child also? I was. Sherry was.
My mother was schizophrenic. So
yeah, so you had to take care of her. And how did you? I mean, did you, as a child, that must have been so frustrating.
It was, but, you know, you do what you have to. I took over, basically became the man of the house when I was 12 years old. She was a single parent. And so I took a responsibility for virtually everything early, very early in life.
Wow, you wish you had the tools you had now.
Yeah, I wish I'd have known then what I know now.
Because you would have been able to say to her, look, Mom, I can't take care of you in all your crazy ways.
Yep, that's right.
You know, Harville Hendricks says, we repeat exactly what crippled us the most so that we could learn mastery over it. And he says, you know, he says not it's just a repetition to recreate, but it's a repetition to get better at it. You've gone the whole distance. You not only got better at it, but you wrote a book about it. I think that Harville Hendricks should know about that. Rhonda, what about you? Were you a caretaker as a child?
Not officially, but when I was in my late teens, I saw my family fall apart over taking care of my father's mother, and ultimately she ended up in a nursing home. And I saw that dynamic play itself out and all of the guilt and the not knowing how to handle a nursing home and looking at nursing home care and not knowing what their rights were. And that changed the course of what I wanted to do with my career, never dreaming that it was going to affect me again personally.
It was going to affect you in as much as you turned into a nursing home specialist, right?
That's correct.
So look at how you had to overcome the powerlessness that you felt. And here's what I think happens with most adults. Powerlessness is such an important issue. As a child, it's an issue. As an adult, it's an issue. When you're powerless to set your boundaries, when you're powerless to be who you are, I think that's where you run into the most trouble. And as children, when we're powerless, somewhere we're going to make this up later in life. Somewhere we're going to have to confront this again. And I can see the two of you did that, but luckily, you found each other and you were able to hold hands as you went through this. And you wrote a book that is of value to people, because the book, it's tough, but it's something worth reading. The name of the book is Tough and Tender Caregiver. My guests have been David and Rhonda Travland. They have a website called caregiverburnout.org, if you want to go to that as well. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Armand.
Okay, thank you. We'll speak again.
Bye-bye.
Okay, thank
Bye-bye.
You. Goodbye.
This is Armand Mill with you with The Positive Mind. We can hang up that quote. Sherry, what do you think?
Well, I think that it's out of challenge on the part of Rhonda and David, the world ended up with some very important advice for many people who are in the situation of giving care to someone who has a chronic illness. And I think that they bring out the point that it's very important to take care of the caregiver as well as the person who's ill.
But they were lucky. More than lucky. I mean, David goes and runs a group. And then his patient comes into the group, right? And then he picks up with her and he goes off and he says, let's dump our mates. You know, let's figure out a way to do it. I mean, as coarse as that sounds, they had a lot of help with each other, having each other there. And both of them are living out childhood dramas, which I hear so many people doing. You know, there's a childhood drama here. David and his mom, that was tough stuff that he went through. He went through that as a child. He must have gotten so angry. As many of us do with our parents, which I think affects our ability to give. And I think where our crooked giving goes, and I was a caretaker, but it didn't get crooked. I had my life, and I had somebody else who had their own life, and it's perfect. But I would say that if you've got a history of this kind of misguided, kind of this illness where you begin feeling your life taken over by another person as a child and you don't know which way to go, it just affects you in later life. Mm-hmm. I think inordinate caregiving or bad caregiving always comes from childhood.
Mm-hmm.
I think otherwise you'd just be too sane to do it the other way.
Right, and I think their main message about setting boundaries is a really, really important one for caregivers. It reminds me of when you get on the airplane, the flight attendant tells you, when the oxygen masks come down, put them on yourself first and then put them on those around you who you'd help.
Well, that's what they said. I mean, they say in the book, take care of yourself first, caregiver. Make sure you've got yours. You're getting yours. And then after that, you know, take care of the person you're with. You know, take care of the person you're taking care of. This is Armand Mill, and that's for the recipients to hear as well. When he or she needs some space, give them that space.
It's all about balance.
They'll love you more for it. We'll be back with you again, my friends. This is really wonderful. Thank you so much, Sherry. You once again bring us beauty. We'll be back with you, my friends, soon. If you want to hear the show again, you can go to WBAI.org or thepositivemind.com. Send me an email with your comments, if you don't mind. Armand@thepositivemind.com. And if you want to get in touch with Sherry Siegel, you could also do that at my office in New York.
are you listening to?
What you were listening to.
Yeah, but I don't know what it is.
It's WBAI.
Wow, sounds weird.
Weird, but I like it.
I like it.
What is it?
It's WBAI.
I like it.
Did you honor your pledge?
To go low carb?
To send money to WBAI.
Well, you mean write a check?
Yeah, I mean write a check.
I wrote it.
Well, now send it.
Oh, send it.
To WBAI.
120 Wall Street.
New York, New York.
10005.
WBAI. I like it.
Yeah!
Tonight's meeting of the WBAI local station board will take place at the station, 120 Wall Street on the 10th floor, between Front and South Streets. The location is wheelchair accessible. Take the 2, 3, 4, or 5 train to Wall Street and walk downhill. Tonight, the board will elect staff and listener members who are not on the LSB to the Management Search Committee. To be allowed upstairs, you must call 212-209-2800 during regular business hours. Please bring photo ID. Again, that's tonight at 7 p.m. at WBAI, 120 Wall Street. Hope to see you there.
On Wednesday evening, September 9, Chris Hedges will be at Revolution Books with his new book, Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle. The book charts the growing divide between two Americas, one reality-based, one faith-based, and the disturbing rise of a post-literate society that craves fantasy, ecstasy, and illusion. Hedges has written many books, including American Fascism, The Christian Right, and The War on America. He's the former New York Times bureau chief for the Middle East, and he will talk about his new book and signed copies on Wednesday, September 9th at 7 p.m. at Revolution Books, 146 West 26th Street. For more information, call 212-691-3345. That's 212-691-3345.
This is Ethan Young, the local election supervisor for WBAI. The WBAI local station board election is underway. WBAI members are voting to fill 9 board seats, choosing from 41 listener candidates. You can hear candidates' campaign statements on WBAI at 7:55 a.m., 2:55 p.m., 5:55 p.m., and 10:55 p.m. And the first public candidates' forum will take place on Thursday, September 10th, at 7 p.m. at the African American Museum in Hempstead, Long Island, 110 North Franklin, 2 blocks west and 1 block south of the Long Island Railroad. For more information, go to our website, www.wbai.org.
Join World Can't Wait and other activists on Saturday, September 12th. In a protest to shut down the Army Experience Center, a high-tech violent video recruitment gaming arcade located in the Franklin Mills Mall outside of Philadelphia. Recruiters are teaching 13-year-olds how to kill by handing them M16s and getting them to sit in Apache helicopters while they shoot the bad guys. Right now, it's only one of a kind. Stop it from spreading. Come out, come protest. Call 917-520-0767 or visit shutdowntheaec.net for more information on the day's action and rides from New York City. That's shutdowntheaec.net or worldcan'twait.org. The world can't wait.
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. And coming up for the rest of the day, coming up right now is What's the Frequency, Kenneth, with Paul Fisher, followed by Talk Back, Hugh Hamilton's Back from Vacation Today, and then Explorations with Michio Kaku, Science, Ecology, and Politics. 6 o'clock, the WBAI Evening News, 6:30, Free Speech Radio News.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.